is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Kurt Doolittle. He is a political and economic philosopher. He has his own philosophy called propertarianism. Kurt, it's a great having you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
How would you describe propertarianism for someone who has never heard about it? You've said it's a political and philosophical point of view based on scientific arguments.
I wrote a piece yesterday for someone who was asked a similar question, and it's a little bit before empiricism comes around, how do you describe empiricism? Before rationalism comes around, how do you describe rationalism? Before reason comes around, how do you describe reason? You could think of it as an evolution of empiricism, I've tried to make it so it's much harder to use error, bias, wishful thinking, and outright deception pollute the commons. In other words, to lie to people. And so, philosophies, I have to be careful because I don't know your audience, right? I mean, I've listened to some of your shows to try to peg it, but it's very easy for me to get far too technical, and I kind of need to know from you guys when I've gotten there or have gone there. So in simple terms, back in the early 90s, I was getting very frustrated, and I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember this, but it's when the Democratic Party just started issuing lists of talking points, and they'd get somebody on a television show and just chant those talking points and not answer questions. And the conservatives were were terribly unable to answer them. Of course, conservatives have pretty much failed for the past 150 years to be able to create a rational or scientific argument to explain their group philosophy or the group strategy. And I decided that I really needed to produce a rational and scientific language that would allow conservatives and libertarians to express their opinions, their thoughts about their group evolutionary model, the same way that the progressives were able to articulate theirs using what they considered to be rational and scientific models, even though they're not so rational or scientific. And so I set out on that little project to produce that language. But along the way, I came across a couple of fairly significant problems in philosophical history, and it just happens to be we're at the right point in time, because of some things that happened in the 20th century, to be able to mature what we call the scientific method from the physical sciences and move it into the social sciences.
So how is propertarianism different from, say, rationalism?
Well, when you give a rational argument, you're basically testing for internal consistency, right? But we know that no system can be closed. In other words, no system of natural languages can be closed. So you can't necessarily prove a language with itself. And so rationalism is basically appealing just to internal consistency and internal correspondence. And it's not appealing to external evidence, in other words, empiricism. And so we'd see people very often make these moral arguments that are internally consistent, but they're not externally correspondent, right? People don't actually act that way. And so I've tried to make the very technical part of propertarianism is really a completion of the scientific method. And I really don't, unless you want to get into that, that's a little probably too technical for an internal introductory conversation.
I first found out about propertarianism through the Greg Johnson interview, and I thought it was very fascinating, as it was kind of this, sounds like an alternative to libertarianism, but you use the word property or proper as fit into libertarianism. And I was reading a bit on the About page, and it looks like this is also something that you have to commit your time to yourself to understand propertarianism, but at the same time, it's almost like it's necessary to learn it. Would you say that?
Think of it this way. we have the common law, right? And we practice law. And there's a law language for law, right? Because terms need to be fairly specific. And so we've got this language. One of the things that was beautiful about the libertarian movement over the past century is it started with Locke, then moved to Mises and Rothbard and Hobbes. And each of these guys tried to create basically a formal logic or an analytical language that reduced all rights to property rights, and therefore could be reduced to an analytical statement of law that was deducible from first principles. Now, for a variety of reasons, those guys failed, but they were pretty close. And so where they say non-aggression, which is an incomplete sentence, I say a non-aggression against property in toto, which means anything that will cause retaliation. And so I've tried to complete that project. So the reason I picked the term propertarianism was to say, well, you know, between Locke in England, Rothbard from the Eastern European Jewish community, Hoppe from the continental philosophy, Kantian tradition of Germans, and me as an Anglo-American in the analytic tradition, over a long time, seems to have created the formal logic of ethics and politics. And
are you saying that the Anglo tradition is preferable to the German tradition and of that of continental Europe?
I'm saying that science is preferable to reason, and that what the Germans write, for example, is moral literature. It's an attempt to replace the state. The church, rather, the church theology with the rational substitute. And the Anglo tradition, which is Bacon was a lawyer, right? I mean, he's studied law. Just like under the Stoics and the Romans and the Anglo tradition is out of the law. In other words, empiricism rose out of the law in England, and that we tend to be an empirical or scientific people. And that we look for ways to reduce things to empirical scientific methods. Whereas the Germans, you know, they produce some pretty good people like Nietzsche, but they produce a whole lot of nonsense too. And, you know, phenomenologists, whatever, where they conflate emotion, they conflate reason, and they conflate religion, and they conflate politics, and they conflate morality in this attempt to restore what Christianity provided. But, you know, if you study European history, what's one of the primary differences between European civilization and every other civilization. We don't engage in conflation. Religion is separate from law. Literature is separate from everything else. Philosophy is somewhat separate. Our governments are broken into separate houses. Our classes are not conflated together into one. So we don't have, you know, the equivalent of what the Jews or the Muslims have, or even the Hindus. We didn't engage in conflation. And the reasons why we didn't do that are kind of fascinating, but Germans, unfortunately, tried to preserve the conflation of the church, and it's still present in their philosophy, which is my reason why the new right movement in Europe has failed to come up with an answer. Whereas if you look at what we've done over here on this side, we've tried to continue the Lockean, Jeffersonian project and produce a strictly constructed law from first principles. Our ancestors couldn't do that, right? When they formed the country, Jefferson sort of understood he needed to do that, but he just couldn't get he couldn't get enough buy-in for something that rigid, and he actually didn't know how to propose it. Doesn't mean we can't propose it now, because law's matured a lot. We've learned how to write relatively strictly constructed law, and we've learned something else, which is called programming. Now, programming is very interesting because it's operational and it's existential. Unlike reason, which the bounds of what you and I can argue by analogy or non-contradiction is pretty loose, whereas we get into mathematics, well, the coverage we can get with mathematics is better but loose. But with programming, there's no exception. You can either do something or can't. Something is existentially possible or not. And so it's possible to write law like we write programming with out of existentially possible statements. If you do that, you can create a strictly constructed natural law that doesn't allow for the kind of thing that we've seen over the past 150 years, which is the combination of Bose, Marx, Freud, the Cantor, Mises, and the whole Frankfurt School.
How does proprietarianism take into account the whole debate about the rights of the individual and individual liberty and what is best for society and the common good?
Well, can you know what the common good is? No, you produce, you can know what the common bad is.
Everyone has their own people debate about what's best for society.
Well, what's best for society is...
There's collectivist ideologies that, whether they're nationalism or socialism, that are about saying, like, let's come together as a society and let's, like, do something that's to benefit the common good. Even if it doesn't always go with what individual people want to do, then there's sort of radical individualism and libertarians who say...
Yeah, see, these are very fuzzy terms, right? Do they really mean anything? Are they reducible to a sequence of operations that are possible? Are they reducible to knowledge that we can actually test? Of course they're not. They're just fuzzy words. They're like talking about angels. They're the only words we have, so we use them. So
all these different political labels like conservative, liberal, socialist, nationalist.
Well, I would go to nationalism, and I would just say that, things like individualism. And I suppose I could tell you a bit of a story of Western civilization, and that might help, but that's going to take me a few minutes, so you got to have patience with me to do that. I would say that, sure, we all, that all those different positions are nothing but justifications of a reproductive strategy of the individuals within the group evolutionary strategy, the group reproductive strategy of the group. And that's it. Now, we can make empirical statements about communism, socialism, social democracy, classical liberalism, private monarchy and total, and what we, the fantasy of total anarchy or anarcho-capitalism. We can make empirical statements about those things, but no matter what statement we make, it's empirical. We can reduce that statement to an expression of reproductive strategy, and that's it. And so, what I tried to do is reduce, and I think I've succeeded, is reduce basically all this discourse from fuzzy words to basically statements of self-interest in the pursuit of action on behalf of individual, group, and national reproductive interests. And so it turns into I succeeded, I think, in creating a morally agnostic, in other words, a moral but unloaded, in other words, unbiased, fairly analytic language for the expression, the comparison, and description of different ethical and moral systems and political systems, and it's basically reduced it to a science. So
it's not like there could be anarcho-proprietarianism or feminist proprietarianism or green proprietarianism. It doesn't mean to make subgenres of subgenres, right? Or
well, so let me further confuse it with more precision. I started out, like I said, thinking, well, I'll just call myself a proprietarianism because I want to show how Locke, Rothbard, Hoppe, and myself have solved this problem over a couple of centuries. What happened is over time I began to understand. So I used that word. In other words, that was the label I chose early, and it sort of stuck. But in truth, the system I refer to is actually natural law, and it consists of testimonialism, which is the scientific method or the complete scientific method, proprietarianism, which is ethics, strictly constructed natural law, which describes what I'm talking about in a fairly strict language, group evolutionary strategy, and from the group evolutionary strategy, the aesthetics of Westerners, which is our long history of domesticating human beings like we did every other animal for fun and profit. That's a complete system of philosophy. It addresses all the issues of all the branches of philosophy. But I mean, I'm not going to walk people through that kind of thing in a few minutes. But the point is that propertarianism would say I can voluntarily construct a socialist society if I want to. In propertarianism, I just can do it honestly.
Propertarianism is based on the core philosophical principles, but it doesn't have this explicit like a manifesto the way like a political party or organization would.
No, I mean, you can build whatever community you want. The end result is going to be determined by how attractive you are as your polity is to join, how competitive it is over the long term, and the rates of innovation that you produce in it. So the reason the West won in the ancient world and in the present and in the modern world, I mean, being backward, poor people, small in number on the edge of the Bronze Age, is because we put together the horse, the bronze, and the wheel, but out of that we developed contractualism, in other words, a militia rather than a hierarchical army, because our weapons were so expensive. We developed, because we had that contractualism, we developed a testimony, truth-telling in the objective sense, rather than the Middle Eastern sense or the Eastern sense.
What do you think about a Chinese philosophers like Sun Tzu? You said in an interview that his philosophy teaches one to deceive in values that are put up for a society.
No, that's correct. I mean, Kissinger's book is about this, I think. They have basically three philosophers, just like we have some major ones that are key influence. And, of course, Sun Tzu's basic argument is delay and deceive. Because wait till you're strong enough and then attack when the other people are weak. I mean, if you want to distill it down to the basic theory, that's it. And that is pretty much that was their first philosopher. And so they've chosen they've maintained that basic strategy throughout history, and they still practice it today. He's their first philosopher. Just as we chose the opposite strategy, which is we're small in number, and we can't hide behind, can't hide behind territory. We're on the steppe. We have to solve problems immediately and severely, because otherwise they'll accumulate and overwhelm us. The Culture of War by Martin Van Creveld addresses this very well. The Karen Armstrong's book, The Origins of God, The History of God, I think is what it's called. That answers it well, and so does The Bronze, The Horse, and the Wheel. Those three books probably address this from three different points. Or if you want to take the modern one, Fukuyama handles it with Trust, his book Trust, and his other book, two books on the history of political systems.
You say you're a part of the conservative libertarian tradition. Is propertarianism correct? The next step after libertarianism? And do you think how much of it is being influenced from the alt-right and libertarianism?
The alt-right. Let's do libertarianism first, then the alt-right. I consider it an extension of libertarianism, but I actually, in other words, in methodologically speaking, but libertarianism is built on the Rothbardianism is built on the presumption of begging for permission for liberty in order to conduct free riding on the commons. Whereas the Western tradition is not liberty, it's sovereignty. And you and I agree to mutually insure each other against impositions and against our property. And that means all kinds of property we can imagine.
So sovereignty can be both your own property and national sovereignty?
It can be anything the people who are willing to fight for it agree.
Or it can also be a communal property, just anything that people are willing to fight for and want to protect.
Or the and well, you know, the problem is once you get into reciprocity, right? So yes, but then you have the problem of reciprocity negating some of the things you can do. So as you know, if the Western tradition is based on in getting as many of us into sovereign positions as possible, so that there's as many of us fighting as possible, and so you sort of grow your way up from human animal to slave to serf to freeman to citizen to sovereign, right? You can earn your way up there. And so what a sovereign does is somebody that I can trust to protect my interests easily. He's his own legislature. And so our tradition is actually sovereignty. When we grant freemen, we grant liberty to the middle class in exchange for compensation. We grant freedom to the freemen and subsidy to those who need it through the church. So, we've always had this hierarchical system, and that's what one of the things that's just truthful about our civilization is we've been truthful about it. And you can construct any polity you want out of this. You just got to understand that the history of our culture isn't liberty, it's sovereignty. Liberty is an artifact of the middle class begging for power when they want to displace the monarchies during the Enlightenment. So I've tried to change it, their concept, from begging for liberty because we say it's a moral good, to saying, well, this isn't working because nobody's buying the message. We need to we need to stop taking a free discount and say there's only one way of creating a condition of liberty for anybody, and that's to create a condition of sovereignty, in fact, without permission.
Is it crucial to take into account the selfishness of a human nature?
How do you mean that?
Well, you wrote a post where you analyzed different economic and political systems. You say that communism doesn't work because people are selfish and minimize their productivity. And then you go on to critique fascism because you say that people are selfish and will use their power to create authoritarianism by incremental control of every way of life. And then you also... you analyze a bunch of systems, but you say out of all of these, you say that a classical democracy like in ancient Greece and a nominative capitalism, you're not saying they're perfect, obviously, but that they're preferable to the other ones you mentioned.
Well, it's the same thing as, do you want to, what's cheaper and more productive? A competitor, a slave, a serf, a freeman, a citizen, or a fellow sovereign? What's cheaper? Well, the reason we don't have slavery is because it's really it's a terrible economic model. And you only do it because you can't create any other. Well, as soon as you can create freemen and citizens and sovereigns, you do because it's always in your interest. So I don't try to make this a moral argument. I don't talk about right and wrong. I just talk about what is. And what is that... it's just cheaper for us to more productive for us to create people who are, to domesticate man and force them from being parasites or predators or free riders into market productive activity. And if possible, take the best of them and ask them to fight alongside us in the preservation and maintenance of our sovereignty. I mean, what we're not doing right now is we're not fighting to preserve our sovereignty. We're walking around like a bunch of beggars on the street looking for people to give us dollars and nickels and thanking them. It's not working. That's what libertarianism is. It's begging. So we need to get past the hopeful generation. The conservatives in 1900 were hopeful that the lumpen proletariat would learn. They enfranchised them. We've been hopeful all along. Maybe they'll learn. Well, not only haven't they learned, they've succeeded in creating a wonderful little religion here, a pseudoscientific religion, to replace Marxism with. So
what's interesting is both liberals and conservatives frame their arguments about issues like income inequality on moralistic terms. Liberals will say, they talk about sort of the concept of fairness and that it's unfair for there to be inequality. But then liberals say The conservatives will say that those who have more automatically are more hardworking, and that people who have less should just shut up about it and kind of know their place in society.
Let's be honest. Why has Western civilization progressed so rapidly in the ancient in the prehistoric, in other words, in our origins, in the ancient world, in the ancient civilization, and in the modern world? Why have we progressed so much faster than every other civilization in those three eras, with intermissions between them, when we didn't exceed the rates of development of those nations? Well, let's look at what we've really done. We learned how to make chariots, and we conquered everything between Spain and northern China. And we've lost most of that territory, although the Russians did a good job of getting some of it back. And now we're losing it from the south. We conquered that. We built the Roman Empire, right, by conquering and domesticating people. And we built, in the modern world, we built the British Empire, the European empires, by conquering and domesticating people. But across all these periods, what we've done very successfully is we've used, starting in about 1100, we started hanging 1% of the, or half to percent to 1% of the population every year. I mean, between that and when 700, we started manorialism, a bipartite manorialism in what's Holland today. The Dutch are so genetically beautiful, is that they've been practicing eugenics longer than the rest of us. If you look at what we've been doing, we've been building a eugenic society for 3,500 years. Mm. We've profited from the domestication of man. And so our aristocracy didn't suppress anybody. They domesticated the animal. And by the time we get to the late Middle Ages, there's nobody left in Europe, or basically the end of the Middle Ages. We got nobody left in Europe who isn't from the middle class or genetically from the middle class. Well, of course, Europeans have lower testosterone levels. We've killed off everybody impulsive, between starving them out, wars, using them for fodder in wars, and hanging one in 10 people, one in 100 people every year. You end up with a pretty pacific situation. Same with the Eastern East Asia. I mean, the Chinese. I mean, they made whacking people who were problematic in industry, and profited from it. They practiced upward redistribution of wealth from the peasantry to the upper middle and upper classes to increase the rates of reproduction, just like we did. We used upward redistribution of production to increase the reproduction, the rates of reproduction of our upper middle and upper classes. So of course we're going to have East Asians and Western Europeans have lower levels of testosterone, higher rates of pedomorphism, and basically more feminine characteristics than the people in the middle who haven't done that.
You make interesting comment, and this ties in with that. I think you were referencing a post by Greg Johnson, but it says, repudiate debts, seize the wealth of enemy elites. And I guess I want to start off with that one thing, because the liberal view towards things that I said earlier is that there should be economic fairness. The conservative view is that they say that people who are economic elites deserve that wealth regardless of who they are or whether how they acquire their money.
That isn't true.
But that's the common issue. I think it was a reference to Greg Johnson. And if people are using, if elites are enemies of the people, their wealth should be confiscated. But
he's referring to Soros, and that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, I agree completely, but not on sort of a egalitarian or principle.
No, because he broke the contract for sovereignty. He broke the contract for sovereignty. In order for reciprocity to exist, you have to limit yourself to productive, in other words, non-parasitic, fully informed, warranted, voluntary exchanges with no negative externalities or limited to only positive or productive externalities. So Soros, what he did is that he intentionally broke the Bank of England and profited from it. This, you know, of course, now the Keynesians or the hard left economists would say he put the money to better use. This is, well, actually, no, because that money was constructed that way in that debt structure based on things that weren't captured in prices.
And are you against usury?
I think there's a usury is the creation of moral hazard. So I think, you know, even though I've worked with companies that, in other words, done technology for companies that have done the check cashing business, I understand that those businesses, at least in America, work pretty successfully at gradually migrating very impulsive people into the ability to hold credit. And so, you know, I'm not against high fees, but what we regulate those companies so that they can't ever more than double the out, right? They can't take more than double the in. Our mortgages, I think mortgages are nuts. I mean, our mortgage we pay three times for, and that's not really two, more than twice for a house when it's our own money. It makes no sense at all.
Do you think, as far as a class goes, that the middle class is the most crucial segment of society as opposed to the upper class or the lower classes?
I think, and the data is pretty clear on this, what's important isn't I'm trying to have you make enough points that I can tie them together, but it's not so much that you need a smart upper class or middle class, is just not need to have a lower class. So this is what I believe accounts for the differences in IQ distributions between races and groups, is that we've just been better at killing off the bottom. And it's not so much we're smarter. We just have nobody left at the bottom.
Most people will call anything dealing with race like racist. Well, it seems proprietarianism will deal with it in the issues in scientific terms. I mean, is proprietarianism...
I just make scientific statements, mm-hmm. and they're either true and false, and my idea of science is not positivist empiricism. It's that you've got to jump through an awful lot of hoops, and you've got to do it in a strictly constructed language with no room for fudging. Okay. So, you know, if you can jump through all those hoops, you're saying something that's pretty hard to consist of: error bias, wishful thinking, obscurantism, propaganda, and deceit. It's just pretty hard to do it and be able to jump through all those hoops, which is how the law works. The whole law creates hurdles, and if you make enough of those hurdles, you know, it's pretty hard to say, well, this guy's innocent. You know, it's the same thing with proprietarianism. I don't try to prove something. I try to make it very difficult to be wrong. And so proprietarianism isn't the justificationary system. We don't go around in this and say, here's what's right or here's what's good. We say only here's what's bad. And we try very hard to suppress what's bad. And the major leap we've made by making this scientific method we call testimonialism is creating all these hoops, is we believe it's, or I believe, and I'm pretty certain my followers believe, that it makes we could put this in a court of law. In other words, we could write it into law. It would be very, very hard to enact legislation or any contract or even make statements, political statements in the public commons, that would be false, misleading, misrepresentational, or deceptive. In most cases, it wouldn't. In other words, what I'm trying to prevent is what the socialists and
You made an interesting comment earlier, how these societies like Western Europe and East Asia have less criminals because they basically kind of wiped out their criminal class.
We were good at hanging, really. We were awesome at hanging. We don't do enough hanging. If I could put two, I realize that I do this on purpose, but I'm trying to put violence back into the vernacular. In other words, libertarianism fails because it's impossible, because no one's willing to pay the high price of using violence to create a condition of sovereignty and liberty, freedom, and redistribution. And so I'm just putting it back there. Hanging worked really well. We did it for over 1,000 years with celebration and joy. And it paid incredible dividends. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure there was much we did over that 1,000-year period that was much more important than hanging 1% of the population. But the minute you enfranchise the lower classes and women, you're not going to get that same reaction.
One thing that that post said is it said, fund a non-reproduction for the unemployable and heavily fund reproduction for 115-plus IQ women. You're kind of talking about these kind of eugenic ideas.
Of course I'm talking about it because I'm saying that's what Western civilization is. Eugenics for fun and profit. We've been doing it for 3,500 years. The whole reason conservatives can't talk in rational and scientific language is because the truth hurts. It doesn't work under democracy. You can't have a eugenics. We can't continue Western civilization under democracy because Western civilization equals domestication of the animal man for fun and profit. What do you think eugenics is? It's domestication of man. It's pedomorphism.
I think one of the problems in society is that the underclass has too much population in numbers, and that there's a small parasitic elite that controls too much of the wealth. What I think would be kind of in some hands like a compromise between the upper classes and lower classes, but it would make sense. So basically, you give a basic income out to the underclass, but under the condition that they lower their birth rates, then you raise, that could work. And then you simultaneously raise taxes on parasitic elites or on parasitic economic behavior, but with tax deduction for like high IQ people to reproduce. So what do you think about the idea of simultaneously doing both at the same time, addressing that sort of dysgenic issue, but also addressing a lot of the economic problems of parasitic elites?
Well, I believe parasitic elites are only possible because of the failure of our intellectual classes to produce expansion of the rule of law to prevent it. In other words, they tried to deal with regulation, which is a via positiva way of doing it, and it's a lagging technology. Whereas if we just put natural law into place and say that with universal standing, so that anybody who sees somebody acting parasitically can bring that person before the courts, or I think the problem goes away pretty easily. I mean, the problem of the financialization of our life is during the 20th century and the damage that's caused, that's pretty terrible damage. But, you know, there's a lot of smart people that have worked on this problem for over 100 years, and I don't think that anybody really understood it all that well until very recently. I mean, this century has been catastrophic. We've taken the wind. I mean, I would say the Greeks, Athens was able to turn its windfall of a discovery of a silver mine into its golden age. And so just like the Athens got a windfall and they abused it, America got a windfall from the purchasing the Western from France, and we got another windfall with seizing the British Empire, and we got another windfall with fiat money. So this, you know, between the industrial revolution, the discovery of petroleum, the obtaining the Western expansion, control over selling off the Western expansion, and inheriting the British Empire's system of law, finance, and trade, and the post-war boon, we had this. Everybody thought that there was a lot of good stuff to go around, and so acted accordingly. But I mean, that, you know, the liberal assumption is that this is going to continue forever. If you look at it, the science of it, I mean, it's pretty simple, is that most of what we're benefiting from isn't our particular brilliance or anything. It's that we discovered petrochemicals. I mean, that's it. I mean, it's just energy. Anyway, so what was your other? So I don't think this is. I think that it's normal for people to get to feel like these huge burdens have been lifted from mankind, but they weren't. They're just shoved down the road farther, and we created a whole lot of problems in this century. And unfortunately, while the boomers profited from it, it's you and me and the next generation that's got to fix it. And we can either let their civilization crash because of these people, or we can pull up stakes and fix it.
How does a proprietarianism take into account ecological and conservation issues? The libertarian argument is that property owners are best at taking care of their own property. That doesn't take into account that there's people who are selfish and they'll own land, and if it's privatized, they'll tear down a forest and do destructive things. How does a proprietarianism address those ecological and conservation issues?
I mean, scientifically speaking, I mean, truthfully speaking, you can't own a piece of property unless other people protect it for you. You can't. So, and that's why we group together in large numbers. So almost no society of the rights, I mean, law is very specific about these things. The right to destroy property or cause harm is generally revoked as a society becomes able to revoke it. People tolerate damage to the environment only so long as they have no other choice. But as soon as they have the choice, they stop it. And so the second thing is that it's not clear that anybody has the right to natural resources. They certainly, that's a commons as well. You can't have that stuff. You can't hold it and get territory if you want. So, part of reciprocity is that there are, we allow fructus, in other words, bearing the fruit of the land. We allow transfer of the property, but we tend not to allow what's called abuses or damage to the property. And this actually is true of, say, like, fine, you can buy the Mona Lisa, but you can't actually hurt it, right? I mean, you don't get that right. You get the right to how to use it, the fruits of it, but you don't get the right to destruction. And so most societies regulate destruction heavily, and they allow only use or fruitful use, and they actually generally limit exhaustion as well. So you can't make the fish pond, the fishing hole, devoid of fish. And as Olson has done so great a job of it. Writing her tome about, communities are actually really, really good at managing those commons privately. And so I want to flip it around and say, you're right. The state ownership, as Hoppe has tried to illustrate, is the worst possible incentive at all. On the other hand, at some point, there's a limit to all privatization.
How much of proprietarianism is based around trust-based society? Because what I've learned is that trust is a huge factor in proprietarianism.
Right. Well, I mean, we go with the basic idea that that sovereignty, right, has no other choice but to rely on truth. The consciousness of truth produces trust, and trust produces decrease in transaction costs, which produces increase in economic velocity, which feeds back to the whole loop, and everybody gets prosperous. So we tend to focus on property rights, which is one ingredient, but that's not enough to create a high trust society that can outcompete other societies. There's plenty of societies with private property rights. There's not many of them that are high trust. Matter of fact, it's almost exclusive to Northern Europe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when describing the history of philosophy, it seems like there's also those philosophers or political figures, as you mentioned, that really messed up and turned everything into pseudoscience. What do you think was the people who've made pseudoscience, and how did this pseudoscience came about?
If these were easy problems, people would have solved them 2,000 years ago, right? So, you get Aristotle with the beginnings of science. You get the Stoics really turn that into natural law. You get the Romans producing basic empirical law. In other words, it's just very pragmatic, and they have their legends and myths and whatever and principles, but all in all, it's a pretty practical property rights law. And so how did you just say that? How did you just ask that question?
Because, you know, the philosophers and political figures. Oh,
philosophers, right. I got it now. So and then you get up to Bacon, and he's like, wait a minute, we can turn this and we can restore this. So I would say the big crime in our history is Justinian's wanted to impose authoritarianism from the East. So he closed the Stoic schools and opened his own school teaching theology. And this probably was, and this is of course not the reason for our Dark Age, but it's probably the biggest intellectual damage to Western civilization. The second is the church didn't teach literacy. Well, first of all, it spread mysticism. It spread this mysticism, and then it didn't teach literacy. It compounded the problem.
Is that like the Germanic tribes being turned into Christians or the Saint Augustine?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and then. Augustine unfortunately solves a lot of the problem of reconciling the difference between the Greeks and the church. And so he creates this pseudoscientific bridge. And so we get stuck with this until, we restore enough of our civilization in the middle class that the practicality of middle class commerce brought about again the emergence of reason. And then from that middle class reason, resolution of disputes in law, and basically the church's investment in places of higher learning, which it did produce, we got enough between the academic class and the commercial class, and the upper middle legislative class, to create enough sort of rational thinking. That we were able to, once the Bacons come along, and we're able to, with the help of the Muslim reintroduction of Aristotle, to put together a restoration of Western civilization. This probably gets messed with because the Germans had been successfully building the Hanseatic civilization, which is probably the next phase of European civilization. And then the discovery of the Atlantic moves all the wealth over to that side. Germany finally solidifies in response to Napoleon. And that civilization starts to restore its place, and they almost get us there, and we get the First World War, and we lose. So I guess it's our job to try to rebuild Western, try to reawaken Western civilization to our origins.
I think a really problem right now in academia is that they teach about the French critical theorists like Lacan, Derrida, and Foucault. I think they're kind of the perpetrators of pseudoscience. What do you say about that?
Absolutely. I mean, French, the Anglos do this thing called empiricism, which everybody's afraid of. So the French come out with, Rousseau's moralism, which is complete nonsense. The Germans come up with Kant, and oh my God, I mean, the guy is so evil, because between Rousseau and Kant, you get Marx. And then the Ashkenazis come out with Bose, Marx, Freud, and they're coming out. Meanwhile, we've got Maxwell, Darwin, Spencer, Davenport, and Nietzsche, and we've got the Pre-Raphaelites and the Romanticists, and we've almost got it, right? I mean, it's just sitting there waiting to hatch, and then we were wrong. We should have let the Germans do their thing and stayed out of it, and we would have, and they would have restored Western civilization. So now what we've got is we get the collapse of Western civilization, the destruction of our confidence in our history, and the saturation of the polity with this submissive stuff. That's why I want America out of Europe, is so that Germany has no choice but to go Marshall again.
a nice way about learning about proprietarianism is you've said that any intellectual discipline with its own methods and terminology takes about a year to learn, 2 years to feel comfortable with, and 3 years to be effective with, 4 years to be creative with, and 5 to 6 years to master.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, I have, I mean, it's not, it's like learning law, right? I mean, it's what we're teaching. We're teaching law. And so, you know, if you look at it, I get the really smart guys, and in 1 year they can be pretty, they can do it, you know? But if you look at a guy like Eli Harmon, I mean, he's devastating, and he can do it in pretty much ordinary language. So, you know, you look at, James or Moritz or I mean, any, I may still go through the list of them, but I mean, some of these guys are, I mean, they're in a couple of years they'll be where I am, not beyond me. It's hard. I mean, if I told you, if you've never programmed a computer before, how long it's going to take you to make an application that will hold up in a production environment, and it's going to take you a couple of years, and it's going to take you a couple of years to be able to do that. If I say to you, well, you know, you've been thinking sideways via positiva for your whole life, and we're still trying to get away from, you know, the philosophical moralism, you know, all that, all those counter enlightenment things that we call the Enlightenment, the French, the Germans, the Jewish, and the consequential British and Americans, all this crap that we've been seeing for this century. I mean, you know, if you've been saturated in that, for you to learn a language that isn't morally loaded, when every part of your being says to you, I need to put moral loading and emotional investment in what I'm saying, and instead try to talk about, you know, psychology, sociology, ethics, politics, law, and group evolutionary strategy without any emotion, it's going to take you a while. It's hard. So. You know, so if you want to be able to practice this and argue it, that's one thing. If you want to know how to create a society, a post-democratic society, you can learn that in proprietarianism in an afternoon. It's not particularly hard. We had it almost right under the monarchies, and we kind of screwed it up there. But I mean, we can create it. It's not difficult.
Have you ever met a professor that was willing to teach proprietarianism to students, or would you say you're the only one? Or do you, how many colleagues do you know who are at the top of learning proprietarianism?
That's funny. You know, I have a lot of professors who follow me, but they won't use their real names. I don't really think of it that way. I have a particular goal, and I set it out like that. The Institute will fund it, and so this year I hope to make time. And I'm hoping I can make time. I have other obligations, but I'm going to try. I'll put out the first course and the second course, and I'll just put the classes together as fast as I can, and people will be able to understand it. It's not impossible, but when, you know, you're going to sit here for, we're going to talk for an hour, and it's pretty hard for me to talk about what's after empiricism before you've seen it. This is the way it was hard to talk about empiricism before you've seen it, you know. But I mean, you're smart guys. I mean, this is the kind of thing where if I made 10-30 minute presentations and gave you examples, you'd get it. It's not that complicated. You just got to want to. The problem for most people is knowing what to invest their time in. You know, the problem for a guy like me is I've been in Hopps circle and the Mises Institute circle, and I've been around a long time, but you know, I didn't really come out public with this until basically 2 or 3 years ago. And you know, how do I tell people it's worth their investment? Well, I don't. I let my followers tell people it's worth their investment, and I let the market choose. And it's, so far, it's choosing pretty well.
It seems like a book on proprietarianism would be the answer, especially if you were to get up a book and understand that.
Well, that's why you do the videos, because by doing the videos you get the book. I've actually got the outline, and I've got a lot of it written. But what I find is that I learn so much every 6 months that I have to revise. And right now I just feel this year that I can reduce it to aphorisms, and that's sort of like the test. Can I do it without requiring? I mean, originally it would take me 20,000 words to say something, then 10, then 5, then, you know, I can say something in 750 words now. It just took me a long time to work through enough of the arguments to be able to do that. And so I figure it's better to take the time and end up as a Spinoza, which is the most parsimonious philosopher ever out there, than end up as a Hegel, which is, you know, it's not Hegel. Or these guys that writes flowery verse going on and on and on, and you have to study it to understand it. So I've tried to circumvent that problem by working harder at reducing it to something that's tangible.
Are you more interested in focusing on the philosophical angle or talking to more like political people who are interested in talking about and debating political policy?
You know, politicians tend not to be terribly bright, honestly.
Well, I don't mean politicians, but just kind of like political bloggers and intellectuals.
Oh yeah, I'm fine. The problem is developing a common ground. Like, you know, I think if you look at the world today, you can see a convergence of Nassim Taleb empirically, Kurt Doolittle institutionally, and Jordan Peterson in literature. And I think that those three guys are saying the same thing in three different languages, and that across us we've probably got a movement. I would have said that movement had more people in it before, but I think you can actually reduce it to those three guys.
And Nassim Taleb, have you spoken to him about proprietarianism, or just saying his ideas are similar?
People tell me they talk to him about me. I don't know. I don't feel comfortable going to those guys until I've published, because I'm asking too much of them. And so what I figure I would do is, we've got a little time here because of Trump, and I'm just going to spend this year, you know, getting to something a little more digestible and getting some material out, and then it's time to talk, you know. It's not like, just as you found out an hour here, you know, it's proprietarianism. How do you know you should invest the time in learning that? Well, I've got to create reason to invest the time in it, and so I haven't done my labor, which is to produce a book, or at least the online courses. And until I do that, I mean, I don't feel like I have the right to request time from these people.
Are you more interested in speaking to the sort of cognitive elite or top intellectual thinkers, or creating sort of a version of proprietarianism, a description of it that sort of is explainable to the masses?
Well, you know, I get better every year, but I find that the guys who follow me are better at communication. And we started out with this basic strategy in 2012, which that my job was to produce first the overall skeleton, which I've done, then produce the book, which I'm book in the classes, which I'm doing, and that that movements are better shared with by followers and people who have an interest in doing it. And so I'm going to tend to work along those lines, only because, you know, there's only so much you can do. And honestly, I always feel that, you know, despite the fact that people seem to love what I talk about, I do think on a certain level, and it's far sometimes hard for me to empathize with people that are on different levels. So I kind of like the way my followers do this, and I'm really proud of them. And that's what we've all agreed they'll do. They'll learn it and go forth. And my job is to be a manufacturer of intellectual arms, and they want to be the distributors. And I think that's probably it. I think when I'll have more influence is if we have to move into direct action, then I think I'll take a more active direct part in it, because that's just something I understand pretty well. But until we actually get to having a revolution, I think I'm better in the manufacturing process than the distribution process.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Kurt Doolittle for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Well, thank you, guys. I never know how these go, actually. I only know after I've heard them. So I hope I did okay on your mm-hmm. side. So appreciate it very much. Smart questions, smart guys. Great show. Very feel very privileged to have been on a guest.
Thank you, and also thanks, Pilliter.
Thanks for being on, Kurt. I'm a huge fan of your work, and I'll look into it. Keep reading the introduction. I've already put it in my time starting actually 3 days ago, actually. I promised to get somewhere with it because now it's on my bookmark on my front page. So
I love you guys. All right. Well, good luck in what you do, and thank you so much for taking time to share with me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.